You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. Coal ash landfills, they're regulated by state and federal rules, but landfill operators may be covered by a single set of regulations if the DNR gets the handoff from the Environmental Protection Agency to take over regulation of the state's coal ash landfills and ponds. So do you live near a coal ash waste site? What questions do you have about environmental risks? We're at 800-642-1234. James Tingem is a professor in the College of Engineering at UW-Madison. His expertise is in environmental remediation, solid waste management, and sustainability. Jim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Kate, always a pleasure to be on.
So explain for us how we get coal ash. How does this byproduct end up in ponds and landfills?
Well, coal ash is the byproduct of the combustion of coal, and it either settles out to the bottom, that's bottom ash, or we collect the fly ash that's up through the air pollution devices. And so we have these two products, typically fly ash or bottom ash, and these products generally need to be recycled or beneficially reused or disposed of in some form of impoundment or landfill.
And I understand the state has 18 coal landfill sites that are regulated by the federal government. How does this all work?
Yes. So we both have federal regulations, but also coal ash has generally always been regulated within Wisconsin. Just going back to history very quick, in 2008, we had the Kingston coal ash spill in Tennessee, and that really sped up the United States Environmental Protection Agency in developing regulations that have been proceeding since then. Wisconsin has always managed coal ash through the Department of Natural Resources in some form of regulatory structure.
What about coal ash is toxic?
Generally speaking, boron is one of the elements that tends to be found in coal ash and released, also sulfates, and to a lesser degree, some heavy metals such as arsenic.
And how, explain how the slurry or that fly ash you talked about, how that's contained.
Okay, well, there's two types of streams. One is a wet stream, and that's where we add a lot of water to the process and you pipe the residuals to an impoundment. And that's typically what's done at the large pond at Columbia. And also, to my knowledge, Weston Pond still use that technology. There are other boilers that can develop ash that is dry. And with the dry ash, which is most common and easier to handle, we basically load it into trucks and then drive it to the landfill for disposal.
Why is the dry ash easier to work with?
Because you can compact it. I mean, you can transport easily, although it's more expensive to transport versus piping in the slurry. The problem with the slurries is it's very wet and you have to drain that water eventually out of the impoundments. And that Kingston coal ash spill in Tennessee, that was a wet ash disposal site. So we have structural issues, stability issues, a lot more things that we worry about.
Can there be leaching? Can there be leaching from the pond?
There can be leaching from the ponds if they are not lined with clay or other, you know, modern landfill lining material.
We're talking with Jim Tingem, an expert on landfill design and management. We're talking about oversight of toxic coal ash waste sites in Wisconsin. Jim, why does the state DNR want to take over regulation of our coal ash landfills and ponds?
Well, first off, for the last 50 years, the Wisconsin DNR has been a leader in environmental programs. You know, back 50, 40 years ago, the federal often would borrow Wisconsin standards, so it's not atypical for Wisconsin to take a lead in something like this in management of environmental products. Two states already have approved programs, Oklahoma and Georgia, so there is a process in play to take that responsibility over from the federal government, and I see no reason why the DNR would not follow suit.
So you feel that the state has the proper staff and resources to regulate these coal ash ponds and landfills?
Well, I can't say what resources they have in play, especially with PFAS and a lot of other things happening, but they have the history to do something like this, and they have the mindset to do it, in my opinion.
How has landfill technology changed in the years since the state's coal ash landfills formed?
Well, it's amazing what's happened in the last 50 years. Many of us probably remember the open town dumps where basically it was just old quarries and holes in the ground. And, you know, in the last 50 years, we've gone to very modern landfill designs with plastics in the landfill, compacted clay, leachate collection systems, air monitoring systems, groundwater monitoring systems. So it's very much advanced. And so we do have modern engineering controls and techniques that we can put into place to safely manage these residuals.
And coal ash can be recycled. Where do you see it in the recycling channels?
Yeah, so fly ash and bottom ash are both actually highly beneficial and sought after by the construction industry. One thing is that fly ash is commonly used as a replacement for cement in concrete because it has pozzolanic properties. And also a lot of road construction projects where we have clayey or soft subgrades, if we mix in fly ash or CCR or coal combustion residuals, it actually very much improves the structural properties of road construction. So again, concrete and road construction are very common places where we see these residuals going for beneficial reuse.
What is the regulation process like if the state DNR would take this over completely? How long of a process is that?
Well, first is the state would have to be at least as restrictive as the federal government. So that's the general requirement. You know, they can't have a program that's less restrictive than the federal rules. This rulemaking process is basically what the DNR would do is develop a plan on how they would regulate the coal combustion residual industry, and they would submit it to the EPA for review and approval as a quote-unquote approved program.
What advantages might that have? What do we know from the states you mentioned, like Oklahoma and Georgia?
One of the things is just it's closer to home. State officials, even though they're always reviewing these, understand the dynamics, the politics, the environmental science within the state. And more so than anything, it just balances some conflicts between existing state rules because Wisconsin NR 500, we already manage solid waste. But some of those regulations, particularly for groundwater monitoring, are different than the federal regulations. So there are some coal combustion residual sites in Wisconsin that have two separate monitoring networks for groundwater because the federal regulations are different than the state regulations. If we put that all together under the state, there's one consistent program that all industry knows that they have to follow.
Well, Jim, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thanks so much, Kate.
James Tingem is a professor in the College of Engineering at UW-Madison. Previously, he was a consultant at engineering firms, has worked on nearly three dozen landfill sites. Coming up, our partners at WisConText reviewed encryption security and the use of .gov domains by Wisconsin counties. We check in on election security in just a moment here on the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We will be talking with Wisconsin's Secretary Designee of the Department of Health Services. Andrea Palm is here in just a bit. What questions do you have for her about how the state health department is responding to COVID-19? What do you want to know about how the state tests for and processes possible cases? Is your health care facility adequately stocked with medical supplies? Where do you see gaps? Bring your questions, your situation right now. We're at 800-642-1234. But first, Wisconsin has a series of elections in the coming months, and the issue of election meddling continues to come up for the state and local officials who are in charge of running these elections. New reporting from our partners at WisconTex takes a look at web security practices by local governments around the state. They found encryption and cybersecurity falling short. Will Cushman is associate editor of WisconTex, and he talked with WPR host Keely Boltina.
We're talking about the Wisconsin Elections Commission and its relationship with local governments. What concerns are happening here?
There are a whole bunch of concerns. First, listeners may be aware of recent action by the commission where they've basically threatened to expose several communities, like half a dozen communities in the state, who are operating their systems with insecure devices, whether they're operating on old software that's not being supported any longer or other things. It's not totally clear. So that they're keeping those communities out of the Wisconsin voter registration base until they update their software or their devices or whatever. To promote security, exactly.
Sure. So it's all under this umbrella of how do we make sure that our elections are safe and that they have integrity. So you have identified really two main problems when it comes to elections websites, those websites that report the unofficial results the night of the election. And one of them is encryption. What is encryption?
Exactly. Encryption is really basically it's essentially, you're scrambling information that's being communicated between a website server and website visitor. And it's scrambled while it's being relayed between the server and the website visitor. And then it's unscrambled when it gets to you. And so what that does is it can keep out potentially malicious actors who could snoop on that connection otherwise and see those communications, or in some instances even reroute website visitors to dummy websites, which is the primary concern.
I get it. So if we're talking and we don't want other people to hear, if they're standing here between the two of us speaking, they would be able to have access to it because we are not in a secure environment, that
exactly.
Sort of thing.
It's called a man-in-the-middle attack by cybersecurity experts. And there are a whole bunch of different reasons why a hacker might execute a man-in-the-middle attack, a whole bunch of different ends. In the case of unofficial election results that are reported on county websites in Wisconsin, the main concern by cybersecurity experts is that a man-in-the-middle attack could basically quietly, without the knowledge of a website visitor, reroute that visitor to a website that looks virtually exactly the same as an official county website, but maybe reports inaccurate information.
So all part of misinformation, the concept of like meddling with elections here, without being secure in HTTP and then the secured websites, they're vulnerable to this.
Exactly. Yep. And that's a good point. So yeah, encryption is, or website visitors will be able to tell if the website they're visiting is encrypted with that HTTPS encryption very easily, usually on the upper left-hand corner of a browser, like in the left-hand corner of the website address bar. There will be like an icon of a padlock that ensures you that your connection is encrypted.
And what did you find in your analysis of local government websites that, you know, dealing with HTTPS?
Yeah, so there are 70, and I should say I only looked at counties for this because they're the ones who operate these websites that report unofficial results on election night. And so 13 of Wisconsin's 72 counties currently, or as of yesterday when the report was published, our report on WisconTex was published, 13 counties did not use the HTTPS encryption security on their websites.
Okay, so those are potentially more vulnerable than other websites too.
To these man-in-the-middle attacks, exactly.
We're talking with Will Cushman, who's the associate editor of WisConText, about his reporting into election security when it comes to websites. And the other aspect of this element of security is the concept of .gov websites. We hear a lot of .coms, .nets. We've got WPR.org, but we're dealing with .com. Why do security officials want local governments, those county governments, to move to .gov websites?
The basis for my reporting is actually a report from McAfee, a cybersecurity vendor. They published a report in February that highlighted the use of HTTPS, so encryption security, as well as the use of .gov in a domain web address name, as two ways that county websites can, or any website that reports official or unofficial voting results, could beef up their security. And the reason for the .gov, it's basically that the federal government vets the use of .gov domains. So if you want to use a .gov domain, you have to prove that you are a legitimate government entity. All those other domains, .com, even ones that seem more official like .org or maybe even .us, which a lot of counties use, anyone has access to those domains if they can pay for them.
So other people could register that aren't the county and make it look like that. But with a .gov, you are really pretty much guaranteed that this has been through the system and that this is the official website.
Exactly. It's really a cue to website visitors that this is a legitimate entity. It's not necessarily more secure than using another domain. Its value is in the cue to visitors.
And what does your analysis show about the number of Wisconsin counties using .gov websites?
Not very many use them. Only 14 in the state currently use them. So 58 counties do not use .gov domains. I've, in the course of the reporting, spoke with officials at a few counties who are looking to make the move to .gov pretty imminently, but not all of them are.
What about election officials in the state? When you talk to them, what are they most concerned about happening if counties don't go in the .gov and the encryption direction?
Wisconsin Elections Commission, they're really placing a higher priority on moving over to the encryption, so the HTTPS. They said that they also recommend moving over to .gov, but they're not placing such a high priority on that. It can take quite a while to get vetted by the federal government. I've heard anecdotally maybe even like a year or so. So that's not as critical of a concern, especially since it's not a direct security issue. It's more about just making sure that people can really fully trust the results that are reported on election night.
And that's a really important point. We should be completely clear. We're not talking about hacking of actual voting machines or the votes, but we are talking about vulnerabilities in how governments report the votes, right?
Exactly. We're not talking about vulnerabilities to physical elections infrastructure or to the state's voter registration databases or anything like that. This is really all about making sure that citizens in the state are able to fully trust the unofficial election night results. So the results before they're canvassed and certified. And really, ultimately, we want to just the purpose of this is to reduce kind of like the potential for election night chaos. Robert Mueller, the special counsel who investigated for years the 2016 election interference in the by the Russian government in the U.S. elections, found that a primary objective of that interference was to just sow discord and distrust in our democratic processes. And so this is a way that objective could be accomplished without actually hacking the voting infrastructure in the state.
And if it is a campaign of misinformation, if counties are somewhat vulnerable because they haven't taken these steps, what is the reason that counties might not move in that direction? You mentioned time and effort.
Yeah, time. At least moving toward the encryption security, there doesn't seem to be a great reason to not do that. This has been a known best practice for years in the business community. It's standard practice. I actually talked to a cybersecurity expert based here in Wisconsin. He's a professor at the Milwaukee School of Engineering. And he said he was really surprised to see that there were any county websites that aren't using the encryption security yet. He called it kind of scary, basically because it could point to larger security holes behind the scenes. And actually, the Elections Commission does provide funding, grant funding, and technical support for making the move to that encryption security.
Will, do we know what other states do? We know that Wisconsin has counties report this information. Is there any move toward anything else?
Wisconsin is unique in that regard. So Wisconsin's election administration is uniquely diffuse. Municipalities are responsible for administering elections, and then counties are responsible for that election night unofficial reporting. They work closely with the Elections Commission, communicate closely with them on election night, but there is no central authority who is reporting those unofficial results, and that's not the case in other states. So it really is all the more important to have those county websites in Wisconsin be as secure as possible.
All right, Will, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Will Cushman, the associate editor of WisConText. He was talking there with WPR host Keely Baltina this week about his analysis of the web security practices of all 72 counties across the state. You can find his full report at wisconText.org. Coming up, we have Department of Health Services Secretary-designee Andrea Palm taking your questions on COVID-19 and how Wisconsin is preparing for the global pandemic. What do you want to know about who qualifies for testing? Have you been denied a test by your healthcare provider? Were they adequately equipped to rule out coronavirus? What do you want Wisconsin's top health official to know? Phone lines are open right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's talk with the head of DHS right after this news update on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin has 8 confirmed cases of coronavirus. Testing for COVID-19 was slow to roll out in the U.S., but in recent days, we've seen private labs stepping up to fill gaps. But big questions remain. How many people have been tested? How many tests are there? And how many people can be tested right here in Wisconsin? What do you want to ask about our state's preparations and capacity in the face of this epidemic? Uva line 800-642-1234. Andrea Palm is the Department of Health Services Secretary Designee. Secretary Palm, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate, for having me back.
Governor Evers calling the state of emergency yesterday. What does this allow your agency, DHS, to do?
So this public health emergency declaration is an important part of how we are making sure that the state of Wisconsin understands that we have moved into a place where we really need to double down on our efforts to slow the spread of COVID-19 here in the state of Wisconsin. And the declaration specifically provides an opportunity for us to access some state resources that could help us pay for things like the cost of quarantine, for example. It also gives us the ability in situations because of the emergency that we might need to provide some regulatory relief to various parts of our infrastructure so that they can continue to do the work they need to do without running afoul of state law and regulation. So those are a couple of the big things that it does. But I think, Kate, the most important thing that people need to understand about this declaration is that it really is our call to action to the residents of the state of Wisconsin to really become our partners in helping to mitigate the spread of this disease and do things that help protect the most vulnerable among us, those who are older and those with underlying health conditions.
Secretary, when you say relaxing some regulatory structures, do you mean specifically in the area of lab testing?
I actually mean broader than that.
Broader, okay.
So, there are things like staff ratios for group foster homes or for childcare facilities or and so in a scenario where there's an outbreak and there needs to be some regulatory relief around some of those kinds of things so that that operation can continue to function without running afoul of those kind of requirements, that's the kind of stuff I mean that impacts all different parts of of our society. And those protections are in place normally for the quality and safety of the those programs and the folks who use them. But in extenuating circumstances like a public health emergency, we need to look on a case-by-case basis when requested at ways that we can help facilitate the maintenance of essential functions without running afoul of some of these requirements.
In recent days, we've heard from public health officials saying that we have to flatten the curve, this mm-hmm. idea that we need to slow the spread and yep. better manage the outbreak and not have these sharp spikes in the number of cases. What is a manageable number of cases in Wisconsin?
So our hospital partners are working very closely with our experts here at the Department of Health Services and on the ground to organize around capacity, around how to think about surge capacity, how to think about how you share resources among local hospitals and clinics and facilities so that we are all in this together around helping to make sure we have what we need in local communities who are experiencing larger outbreaks. I think this will continue to evolve here as we understand more about the disease, about the outbreak, about who is suffering a severe illness. But our hospitals are very much focused on their capacity to serve folks in need.
You have a line right now to DHS Secretary Designee Andrea Palm, Wisconsin's top health official. What questions do you have about the state's response to COVID-19? What do you want to know? Are you in self-quarantine? Tell us about your situation and what you want clarity on. We're at 800-642-1234. Let's take a call. Kenneth is here from Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
I'm wondering, what is it going to cost? In that I've heard $300, I've heard $3,000. What is it going to cost in Wisconsin? And can animals pets transfer
okay,
virus?
So yeah, Kenneth is asking the cost of a single test.
Here in Wisconsin, the tests are fee exempt. There is not a cost for the test. If you receive a test at a private lab, they may have their own fee schedule, but we here at the state government have encouraged our insurance providers to work with labs to waive those fees for individuals. But it is our goal that cost not be a barrier to accessing a test.
Well, let's talk about the testing process. There has been a lot of questions around it. How does the testing process work?
Mm-hmm. And so as this has evolved here, our guidance has evolved as well. And we currently have returned all decision-making about who needs to be tested for COVID-19 to physicians. So originally there was a requirement for consultation and to discuss an individual patient before a test was allowed. That is no longer the case. So what folks should do is if they are experiencing symptoms, they should call their doctor, they should have a conversation and take direction about how to come into a facility to see your doctor. We want to make sure we're not exposing other people. If you think you might have the illness, so please call ahead, have a conversation, get instruction about how to come into your facility. But if your physician deems it necessary for you to receive a test, you can be tested. And currently what happens is either the facility has its own contract with a private lab that is up and running and doing tests, or those tests go by courier to either the state lab or the Milwaukee Health Department where they are run and those results are then returned to the to the physician who requested it.
I know privacy for you has been a real big concern you've expressed to keep the names of the people who have been tested positive as private, but other states have been reporting the ages of people who test positive. What can you tell us about the ages of the 8 who have currently tested positive in Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. You're right, Kate. We have not been releasing ages of folks. Our goal, as you stated, as I have said, is to protect the privacy of folks who have been infected. And when you think about smaller communities in the state of Wisconsin, the more information you provide, the more easily identifiable someone is. I think what we know about the disease here in Wisconsin, in the nation, and across the globe is that folks who are older and folks with underlying health conditions are more susceptible to severe illness. And so we are encouraging those folks to be very vigilant about their own social distancing, about the decisions they're making about travel, about going to gatherings, and do things that are more protective of themselves. And that is our responsibility as well. If we aren't one of those populations, to stay home when we're sick, to not expose people who might be more susceptible to severe disease to the chance of getting sick. We all have to be part of the solution here, of reducing the spread and mitigating the impacts on the state of Wisconsin.
Let's take another call. Jim in Columbus. Hi, Jim.
Morning.
Good morning.
Hey, you were discussing just a little bit ago about the need to flatten the curve and sort of lengthen up the time frame for it to go through the general population. Now, it seems like in the past, pandemics have typically burned themselves out in, I don't know, it seems like 6 to 18 months maybe. What if by doing this, we sort of now lengthen that time frame to where it goes on for years?
Jim, thank you for that question. Secretary Palm, Jim said, scratchy line there, but pandemics, he said, usually take 6 to 8 months to play out. This could be years?
Mm-hmm. As it relates to flattening the curve, which you're right, Kate and Jim, folks are rightfully focusing on that. I think it's a really it's a great way to think about how we mitigate and manage this. I think what we know about pandemics previously does provide some helpful information, but we cannot and should not think that this one will be exactly like others. And so we really do need, while we are thinking about flattening the curve, the reason for doing that is to ensure that the capacity of our healthcare system can handle severe illness that happens with the outbreak. And so a more sustained outbreak that has fewer spikes or fewer surges allows the healthcare system to manage an outbreak in a way that people can get what they need when they need it. And so I think we, as Jim mentioned, are focused on doing those kinds of things that allow our healthcare system to manage folks as they become sick, and that the severest of those get what they need from the system of writ large.
We're talking with Department of Health Services Secretary Designee Andrea Palm about our state's preparation for COVID-19 and the status of testing, of quarantines. Your questions front and center, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. The morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Wisconsin's top health official, DHS, Department of Health Services Secretary Andrea Palm, on the line. She's addressing the state response to COVID-19 now that the governor has declared a public health emergency. DHS confirmed 2 new cases yesterday in Dane County due to community spread. That brings a total number of active cases in Wisconsin to 8. Bring your questions on testing, quarantines, active cases, what you want clarity on. Secretary Palm stays with us. Our number, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Vicki now, joining us from East Troy. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. Hello. Can you hear me?
We can, yes.
Oh, good. Okay. My question, and I have been looking on the internet, and I called the Department of Health to ask the question, is what happens when our negative pressure beds in our hospitals are full? What is the plan? And I haven't heard anything as far as containment or if we're going to designate a specific hospital. I know Georgia has a specific area where they're preparing, and I have not heard anything from our state in that regard, and I'm hoping there's a plan.
Secretary Palm?
Yes, thank you for that question. A couple of questions in there. The first of which, I actually forgot what the first one was.
Wants to know the state's plan. Once the beds are filled at hospitals, where is there a central hospital? What do they do then also with bodies?
Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned earlier, we're working very closely with our hospital partners on what our capacity is and how folks are thinking about their resources, what we need to do to make sure smaller hospitals who may not have capacity, what their partnerships are with others to be able to help share the burden, et cetera. As it relates to negative pressure rooms, as we learn more and more, which I think was the first question.
Mm-hmm. So yes.
Sorry about that. As we learn more about this illness and the fact that it is spread by respiratory droplets, I think you will see a move to reduce the reliance on negative pressure because it is not airborne. It is these respiratory droplets, and so that will allow us certainly to not be in this box of how many negative pressure rooms we have, and that will be very helpful in allowing our capacity to be greater than what it would be if we purely restricted what we need to be doing to the capacity of a negative pressure room.
So as you listen to hospitals around the state, do they have enough testing kits on hand right now?
Mm-hmm. And so, right, you have to have validated that you can run the test, right? The, mm-hmm. the FDA, the federal government, has released the recipe, the formula for the test, but folks have to have the equipment. They have to have be able to run the test in a valid, reliable, and accurate way, and then they can start running the test. And so some hospitals are in the process of doing that. Some already have. But you need to do that before you can run this particular test because it is new. And so this various hospitals are in various stages of having the capacity themselves to run tests, but it is an important part of what we need to continue to be doing to expand our access to test here in the state of Wisconsin.
Let's bring in Jason now in Milwaukee with a question. Jason, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm curious to know if the state is going to be supporting any drive-through testing centers or central testing locations that folks can go to get tested. Mm-hmm. I know a significant amount of people who have had symptoms similar to what's being, discussed about COVID-19, and there's just no way of them to know if they have it because there's no easy way to get tested at this time.
Mm-hmm. So, Jason, I do think folks that are experiencing symptoms need to call their doctor, and they need to have a conversation about how to come in and get a test. Because folks experiencing symptoms should absolutely get tested. We are exploring a variety of ways to expand our testing capacity, including this concept of drive-through or central locations for testing. We are also doing a lot of work the State Lab of Hygiene, I should say, is doing a lot of work with private lab partners to expand our capacity here, as well as I mentioned, the hospitals that themselves are working to expand our capacity. So we think we need to be looking at all the options and leaning in to expand access here as much as we can.
Secretary Palm, what guidance are you giving school districts right now as they consider whether to close?
So we are anticipating more formal guidance to come out of the department here soon. But I do think folks need to be looking at the guidance that is currently out there and thinking about how, from a mass gatherings perspective, they are mitigating those kinds of activities, as well as thinking about opportunities for social distancing, for reducing unnecessary things that are not essential activities of the school, extracurricular activities, assemblies where you're gathering larger numbers of students in one place for a longer period of time so that there is more sustained close contact. So we are really encouraging schools to take the practical steps that they can to do the kind of work that is common sense, that is practical hygiene things, enhancing their cleaning of their facilities, double down on the cleaning and the frequency of cleaning, those kinds of very basic, important public health steps can help reduce the likelihood of spread in schools. But we really do think folks need to look very seriously at non-essential activities in schools and these social distancing strategies to reduce the number of children in contained settings for long periods of time with close contact.
Let's go to Rick now in Madison with a question. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, my question is, we heard in China they're doing x-rays now, and then it shows up on an x-ray. And then the second part of that is, we also heard in South Korea they're doing drive-up clinics. People are, they're going to test everybody. You just drive up and get your test done.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with that first one. Here. Yeah, Rick, thanks. On x-raying, Secretary Palm.
I don't know the validity of an x-ray test as it relates to this disease. What I do know is that we have a valid and reliable and accurate test. We currently do not have a backlog of tests. People who need to be tested can get tested and should get tested. But certainly, I'm sure if there is an option to expand testing through other means, our scientists are looking at it, as I'm sure are the scientists at the federal level.
Secretary, we have 37 Wisconsinites returning home from the Princess cruise ship who might have been exposed. They'll be in self-quarantine. How will their condition be monitored?
So we are actually in very active conversations right now with the Department of Health and Human Services about our residents who are currently on military bases to organize their return home in a way that is safe for them and for our National Guard partners who are going to help us safely get them to their respective homes across the state. Folks who are experiencing symptoms, we do not plan to bring those folks home on the same plane as those who are asymptomatic. Folks will receive testing, and once they are back here, they've already been connected with their local public health departments for their self-isolation and monitoring.
And we have to leave it there. Andrea Palm, thank you, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. If you have questions, there is a hotline, 608-720-5300. That's 608-720-5300. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.